Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Uncork the Sun with the Vince DeToot Wine School. I was and continue to be your host, Moss Sherkogel. And because time is a flat circle, and because 2020, while scientifically the shortest year we've ever had, was, in the eyes of the beholder, longer than the life cycle of the Earth, it means that you may have just finished listening to episode 12. And so this might not seem like any time has passed at all, but to me, this is the beginning of season 2 after half a year of hiatus. And I have absolutely no idea how to do this anymore. I suppose it's debatable whether I ever had any idea how to do this, but I have always stubbornly insisted that you, the audience, listening to me muddle my way through how to make a listenable podcast is part of the appeal, and I'm not going to be dissuaded of that belief now. So here we go into season 2 of Uncork the Sun with the Vince DeToot Wine School. I will hold for applause. Season 2 is going to be a little bit tighter. We're coming in with just 6 strong episodes. We have some fantastic interviews lined up that I'm really excited to show you. And we're going to start today with a topic that, honestly, I'm shocked that I didn't discuss yet in the previous season. You see, in season 1, we really set the stage. We tried, I say we, as if this podcast wasn't just me sitting on my bedroom floor recording this alone while my kids play in the other room. But season 1 was trying to set up the fundamentals of how wine is made, so that you get a proper understanding of the industry from the perspective that we have as growers and winemakers and wine sellers. But I've realized that I left out a greater context, because the group that I belong to, the South Okanagan wine community, is not just a group of grape growers and winemakers. It's a group of BC grape growers and BC winemakers. And that's actually really significant, because British Columbia is in some ways an unexpected place for wine to be coming from. At least in the eyes of the world it is. And that's why today I'm going to deliver some much-needed context by delving into the history of wine in British Columbia. Canada has a reputation for being cold. I probably don't need to tell you this. And grapes have a reputation for growing in places that are hot. You look at Italy. It's got like 3,000 different grape varietals there, and most of those thrive in temperature conditions that I would argue that humans shouldn't even be in. Canada is also very young as far as countries go. I'm sure we all remember the 150th anniversary celebrations we had, because they were 4 years ago. We are barely over 150 years old. There's no shortage of Canadians who have been alive for more than half of the history of the country. That is wild. Compare that now to the history of wine. The oldest winery in France has been continually producing wine for over 1,000 years. The oldest winery in the world is more than 6,000 years old in Armenia. And even the oldest American winery predates Canada's Confederation by about 30 years. So given these factors, it's not surprising that the heartland of Canadian wine is out east, in Ontario. It was one of the earliest areas in Canada to be colonized. They had a big head start over the western provinces. Plus, Ontario is a lot further south than the southern border of BC. This is something I always forget, having lived in British Columbia all my life. But the Niagara region of Ontario is fully 800 kilometers further south than the BC land border with Washington State. In fact, Niagara is only about 240 kilometers north of the northernmost tip of California. If they were on the same horizontal plane, it would take about 2 hours in the car to get there. And so the birthplace of Canadian wine, of course, was in an early settled area with a southern latitude that permitted it much warmer conditions than a lot of other parts of the country. And so the first formalized grape plantings in Canada for the purposes of wine production took place in 1811 in Cooksville, Ontario. The first Canadian winery, 1866. And by 1890, there were 35 Canadian wineries, all of them in Ontario, mostly in Essex County. Now, as I've mentioned, British Columbia is a little bit behind the East. Vancouver was founded almost 100 years after Toronto was founded. And so BC's wine industry was also appropriately delayed. The city of Kelowna was established in 1905, and in 1932, the winery of Kelowna was established. The winery is spelled different, of course, it's C-A-L-O-N-A, but it was still a bit of a stake in the ground saying, this is the winery for this place. And it was also one of the first wineries in all of British Columbia. One of the first, we'll get back to that. It was founded by two fellows with extremely 1930s names. It was Cap Capozzi and W.A.C. Bennett. Notably, neither Capozzi nor Bennett actually drank alcohol. But the partners agreed to create the winery as a way to revitalize the local agriculture scene, which was floundering into poverty at the time. To take advantage of a surplus of fruit that they were sitting on because of the Great Depression, Capozzi and Bennett started producing apple wines at a winery that was originally called Domestic Wines and Byproducts Company. Because this was a very bad name for a winery, a few years later, it was renamed to Kelowna. The first apple wines really said it all. They were called OK Red, OK Clear, OK Port, and OK Champagne. An extremely low bar being set right here. Ironically, a lot of these apple wines failed to even live up to that level of expectation and were actively bad, many of them apparently fermenting on liquor store shelves and having to be thrown out. Eventually, Kelowna did move into producing grape wine, which was, by all reports, not much better than the apple wine was, but it was a consistent theme in early British Columbia wine production for producers to be making the wine out of alternative fruit. I said that Kelowna was one of the first wineries in British Columbia, and it is, in fact, still the oldest continually operating winery in British Columbia, since it does still exist, making, thankfully, much better wine than it used to. But it did have a couple of predecessors, of all places, on Vancouver Island. In 1923, the Growers Wine Company opened up in Victoria, British Columbia. That was the first licensed winery in BC. And it was joined a few years later in 1927 by Brentwood Products Limited, the second winery in BC. But both wineries were producing Loganberry wine at the time. Eventually, Brentwood Products Limited changed their name to Victoria Wineries. In the early 30s, Growers bought out Victoria Wineries, they merged together, and Growers continued to produce wine right up until the late 70s when they shut down that aspect of their operation. But the existence of the famous Canadian Growers Cider is the lasting legacy of the first BC winery. On Vancouver Island, after Growers shut down its wine production in 1977, it took until 1992 for a new winery to be founded on the island. That was Zanatta in Duncan. But over in the Okanagan Valley, vineyards and wineries had continued to grow through the 20th century. And next, we're going to talk about some of the modern pioneers of British Columbia wine. The modern history of British Columbia wine is not so much a history of winemaking as it is a history of grape growing. Indeed, most BC wineries today still adhere to the concept of the ground-up winery. That is to say, grape growers, viticulturalists, farmers, learning the trades of winemaking to create a home for their fruit, as opposed to winemakers coming in and looking for fruit to use. But it did take a while to cultivate this pride in our province's grapes. The first grapes in British Columbia were planted in 1859 at the Oblate Vineyard in Kelowna. They were Monkley grapes planted to become sacrament wine by the famous French Catholic priest Father Pandosi, the founder of British Columbia viticulture. But when Kelowna Winery started producing grape wine, it wasn't grown in BC. It was California grapes that were imported up into the province. But then there were some interesting twists. In 1952, British Columbia elected a new premier, and he would become the longest-serving premier in BC history for 20 years in office. In that time, he had many achievements, of course. He was the premier who brought in the provincial BC flag, for example. But he also provided great assistance to the BC wine industry, in the form of protecting provincially grown grapes. In 1962, it was mandated that British Columbia-produced wine had to contain 50% British Columbia grape juice, a huge move to protect domestic product. In 1965, just a couple years later, that number was increased to 65% BC juice in any BC wine. And just another 4 years later, in 1969, the number was up to 80%. British Columbia wine had to contain 80% British Columbia wine juice. Wine juice. wine juice isn't a thing. Grape juice. Grape juice. Wine. Had to be 80% BC stuff. So who was this benevolent premier? This politician who championed BC grape growing? Well, it was a man of many contradictions. A man who didn't even drink wine, and who started his own winery by buying California grapes. It was W.A.C. Bennett, the co-founder of Kelowna. And when the province elects a winery owner as its provincial leader, that's when you know that wine is gonna start to matter. We had vineyards, yes, and we had some wineries that used them. But all through the mid-20th century, the perception of BC wine was best encapsulated by a one-liter bottle of Kelowna Royal Red. And this was not, I would say, something to be proud of. We have to go back once again to the perception of what Canada is. That is to say, a rugged, frozen, frontier wilderness. The finest grapes in the world at that time, and at this time, are Vitis vinifera, the European grapes that are used to produce things like Riesling and Merlot, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and any other number of globally popular wines. North America has its own type of grapes that grow here naturally, Vitis labrusca. These produce things like Concord grapes, great for juice, wonderful for raisins, not objectively good for making wine. And yet it was certainly perceived at the outset of the BC wine industry that BC should be and maybe only could be growing labrusca grapes. After all, they were native to Canada, they were adapted to cold temperatures, and so labrusca was the standard, with the only compromise being the introduction of hybrids. Hybrid grapes that were created as a cross between vinifera and labrusca, say, or other genuses of grapevines. Things like Marechal Foch, a hybrid red grape that was brought over to Canada in 1946. These native grapes and these hybrid grapes were perceived to be kind of all we could do here. And it put a definite limit on the level of quality that BC wineries could produce. But that started to change in the 1970s. Actually, the change started a little before that, in 1968. Because 1968 is the year that Incomeep Vineyard was founded. Located just to the east side of the town of Oliver, on band land and 100% a Soyuz Indian band owned, Incomeep Vineyard is a Class 1 site, meaning it is one of the most superbly perfect locations for growing grapes, with a high number of growing degree days, less than 10% chance of frost except for a few tiny frost pockets, well-drained soil, and a large amount of sunlight. Because of the ideal nature of the site, Incomeep Vineyard was the perfect place to do a little bit of experimentation. And in their early years, they planted Riesling. They planted Cabernet Franc, Gamay Beaujolais, Merlot, Cab Sauve, Chardonnay, Semillon, Chenin Blanc. They took a risk and they tried planting grapes that many people believed couldn't be grown in British Columbia. High-quality fruit, the sort that was making internationally recognized wine, and they were doing it right here in our frozen Canadian wilderness. The vineyard was an inspiration to the BC wine industry and also to the residents of the band. Anybody familiar with the vineyard already has surely heard the name Sam Baptiste. Sam was working at the vineyard when it was first started, when he was a teenager. In his early 20s, he was actually elected as the chief of the Soyuz Indian Band, and he served from 1976 to 1984 when he retired to further his education about horticulture. And then he returned to take on management of the vineyard in 1990, and he's been the manager since then. People like Sam and the others who founded the vineyard and kept it running in those early years demonstrated the potential that BC held for higher quality fruit. And in 1974, a famous project called the Becker Project was put into place to determine the suitability for noble grapes. The Becker Project's vineyard was located just off of Black Sage Road, a beautiful location that is now owned by Phantom Creek Estates, and is developed under the name of the Becker Vineyard. Back in 1977, the Becker team planted 30 different grape varieties on the land to see what would work well in these South Okanagan growing conditions, and the results were extremely favorable. Between the Incomeep Vineyards and the Becker Project's vineyard, it was determined that British Columbia was capable of producing fantastic quality Vitis vinifera, the very same European grapes that were hailed the world over as the pinnacle of wine production. A few years later, in 1978, Sumac Ridge was granted the first estate winery license in British Columbia, signifying it as a winery that grew its own grapes on site. Other wineries followed. In 1985, the Geringer brothers produced their first vintage from their estate vineyards on the west side of the Okanagan Highway between Oliver and Osoyoos in the area that would eventually become known as the Golden Mile. Walter and Gordon Geringer had spent years in Germany training in the arts of winemaking and viticulture, as their father and uncle did a 7-year soil survey throughout the South Okanagan, looking for an ideal vineyard site. The previously iconic Inkemeep and Becker vineyards had been planted on the east side of the valley, capturing the afternoon sunlight, but the Geringers settled on the west side. And from their foundational vineyard, we see the beginnings of the distinction between the Golden Mile bench and the Black Sage bench, both equally significant to the modern BC wine industry, but with the capacity to grow different styles of grapes. All of this early experimentation was really put to the test in 1989. What happened in 1989? NAFTA. NAFTA happened in 1989. The North American Free Trade Agreement suddenly meant that Canadian wines no longer had market security. You see, the BC wines of limited quality that had been produced for much of the 20th century had always been able to capture domestic sales because any imported wine was subject to heavy tariffs. But NAFTA meant that suddenly Canadian consumers were about to have access to American products at lower prices than ever before. Canadian wine was already cheap, it couldn't really get cheaper. So it had to get better. And so in that very same year, 1989, the federal and provincial governments co-funded a massive pullout of older vines. They paid for farmers to rip up their Labrusca, rip up their hybrid grapes, and replant them with vinifera. BC took a huge gambit, asking farmers to rip out all of their crops and start again from scratch, with most grape varieties taking at least 4 or 5 years to grow back to maturity. There were lean years as the grapes grew back. But when they did, it was a whole new era. And the year 1990 also saw the creation of the BC Wine Institute and the Vintners Quality Alliance, governing bodies to create levels of standardization to ensure that BC-made product was produced to the highest level of quality with these new high-quality grapes. And that was it. That was the beginning of modern British Columbia wine. Between the year 1990 and the year 2020, the 1,300 acres of grapes planted in BC has gone up to more than 10,000 acres. The 115 vineyards in 1990 have gone up to 929 vineyards now. There were 157 VQA standard wines. Now there are more than 2,000. And back in 1990, there were only 19 grape wineries. And in 2020, there are more than 282. The types of grapes that we are planting have changed. A lot of the names have changed. Very few of the BC Wine Institute's original founding member wineries are still open today, 30 years later. But the legacy of these original founders is undeniable today, in the proof that you can create world-class wine and grow world-class grapes in a frozen chunk of the wintry north in a country that's barely 150 years old. Thank you all for listening to Uncork the Sun today. It's very good to be back recording this. And if you found any of the history of the BC wine industry interesting, then you definitely shouldn't stop with this cursory and mildly factual overview. Instead, I'd recommend one of the best resources on this subject, the book Values of Wine by Luke Whittle. It is current, it is very well informed, and I just cannot recommend it highly enough for wine or history enthusiasts alike. To learn about the wineries of Oliver Osoyoos Wine Country, your place to go is www.oliverosoyoos.com. In addition to this podcast, we've also restarted our live virtual Vinstitute broadcasts, with the first episode airing last week. These live tastings will air on the last Tuesday of every month, so the next one will be on April 27th. You can see those live on the Oliver Assoyous Wine Country Facebook page, or you can watch them after the fact on Facebook or on YouTube. To post about this show or the live tastings, use the hashtag UncorkTheSun. This podcast is a collaboration between Oliver Assoyous Wine Country and the Vinstitute Wine School, and is released on the first Tuesday of the month. If you have any questions about wine or winemaking or any topics that you'd like me to discuss, feel free to email me at moss@vinstitute.ca. The music for this episode was provided by Olav. To hear more of his work, visit olav.bandcamp.com. I was going to get him to produce some new music for this, but I got busy and I forgot about it. Maybe I'll remember for next month. The host has been me, Moss Scherkogel, and now that I'm done recording, I'm going to kick back with some world-class wine juice. Whether you're experiencing the beauty of Oliver Assoyous Wine Country from the comfort of your home or planning a trip there for the future, we cannot wait to raise a glass with you and uncork the sun together.